Welcome to Modern Church History. We're covering 1275 to the present. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Wett. Welcome, Father.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
It is very good to see you back in that chair again. We're going to be covering old territory.
Yes, that's right.
I guess in two ways. We have done this program before, but we're going to do it again, and we invite you all to stay with us for many weeks to come as we cover modern church history, as I said, from 1275 to the present. Father, if you're ready, I'm going to let you begin and introduce today's program.
Well, I'll just start by saying that I think we lost those tapes.
Unfortunately.
Some ways, but some ways not.
Well, exactly, because now you're back.
It's true, and I've read a lot of books since then. I've gone to trifocals with all of that. In fact, this past summer I was preparing for a course that I taught at Kendrick Lennon Seminary, and this past spring, or fall rather, and went down to the library and began pulling out all the best literature of this period of time, and ended up carrying 3 feet of books home.
Oh my gosh.
I put them in my bedroom on one side, and then all summer long, that's all I did was just read down the...
Wow.
But I learned a lot.
Well, good.
So hopefully we'll be able to share some of that with everyone this time around.
Wonderful. And I know before I asked you, and I didn't even ask you before we started the program again, but hopefully along the way you'll give us some books that we might read to help
definitely.
Ourselves.
Yeah, I brought a couple with me today. I'd like to just, maybe we could start out by recommending some of those. These are all available. They can be gotten through any of the Catholic bookstores here in St. Louis, so they're certainly order them. Certainly the one that I would just really recommend people get, and I've recommended to so many people, is it's called A Compact History of the Catholic Church, and it's written by Alan Schreck. It is compact. It's about 175 pages long, very readable, and just really a solid little work on the history of the Church. So that's one that...
He's one of my favorite authors. So,
yeah. Yes, yeah, he's very readable. Very,
yes, very.
Good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another one to go along with that, and it's a bigger, thicker book. It's called A Concise History of the Catholic Church, and that is Thomas Bockenkotter.
All right, spell that one for us.
Okay, it's B-O-K-E-N.
Okay.
K-O-T-T-E-R.
Okay.
And this also is a real standard history of the Catholic Church, used in a lot of schools, colleges, as seminaries, as a history of the Church. I found that the best part of this book is at the back. The index is incredible. You can go ahead and you come across somebody, you go, I've heard of that person somewhere between, Eusebius of Caesarea. Now what? And then you find it right there. He's got it right there.
Great.
So that's a really fine book. And then another one to go along with that is it's called A Short History of the Catholic Church. And the author there is Jose Orlandis. It's Orlandis.
Okay.
Also, it's quite brief. It's about 150 pages long, but it has a lot of wonderful insights. It is a good companion with Alan Schreck's.
Okay.
It takes a slightly different approach on some things, and both of them are just really, really great books. Another book that I've discovered in the last 2 years, also very recently written, is called Spiritual Masters.
Okay.
And this one is popular with the seminarians. Last semester, when I looked over the evaluations, and I had assigned this book as one of their textbooks, and several of the seminarians had written in their evaluations, "Don't drop Hughes." Who is the author of Spiritual Masters? The author is Archbishop Alfred Hughes, the Archbishop of New Orleans.
Okay.
And a very interesting story. He himself was a church historian. Later became the rector of a seminary where he had been teaching at, and then nabbed to go to Baton Rouge, where he became the Bishop of Baton Rouge. And he arrived there, and he still had this great love of teaching and great love of the church, and people just asked him if he wouldn't share that with them. And so he set up like weekly evening sessions where people would drive from all over Louisiana. I mean, not just in Baton Rouge itself, all over, would come in, and he would take them through some of the great spiritual masters of the Catholic Church. And so this book is quite short, but it deals with some really wonderful people: Teresa of Avila, Catherine of Siena, Francis de Sales, Ignatius of Loyola, John of the Cross. That particular chapter is just, it'll blow you away. It's wonderful. Augustine, a number of others, and it's very readable. What he does is he talks about the history of the period and the church and what's going on there, and then how this individual spiritual master is impacted by the period, and then how he or she then touches the eternal gospel, and in his or her own writings then expresses that, and you come up with these great masterpieces. So it really is a wonderful way, as you're working through church history, it's a wonderful way to see the great spiritual depth and treasure that's available. And he does just a wonderful job. About a year or so ago, he was transferred to the Big Easy, where he is now the Archbishop of New Orleans. But just a real gracious guy.
Does he give then a different perspective on those saints than we might get otherwise? Or
yeah, because in the other three histories, you're going to get the history of their lives. Mm-hmm. Here, you're going to hear them.
Okay.
You know, he'll take passages from their writings, so they'll be able to actually speak to you. And so it gives a real three-dimensional sense of the history that you're reading.
That sounds wonderful.
I haven't come across many other books that do that, and certainly do that as well as this. So it's called Spiritual Masters, and I'd really recommend it to anybody.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll go look those up.
And then I guess as we go along, I'll throw in some other books from time to time.
Yeah.
We'll do that. But well, let's go ahead and get started with today.
Do it.
You know, it certainly sounds strange to talk about modern history. Whenever anyone asks me what period do you teach, I say, "What's modern church history?" And they say, "Oh, where does that begin?" And I tell them it's in 1274. And then you get this strange look, which was probably the same look I had when I was told that's when we would begin.
Uh-huh.
My own studies from St. Louis University were what we thought of as modern history would begin sometime after the Renaissance and Reformation.
Right.
You know, maybe as late as 1648, the end of the Thirty Years' War. 1715, the death of Louis XIV. I remember one curriculum that was built on the modern history beginning in 1815 with the defeat of Napoleon. And then all of a sudden to find out that modern history begins in 1274 was kind of a jolt. But, you know, as the church thinks in terms of centuries and millennia,
right.
not in terms of years and months,
right.
It made a lot of sense. Because as you look at the whole flow of church history, you come to the culmination of what is referred to as the medieval synthesis in the 1200s, in the 13th century. You know, this tremendous century in which you have so many great writers, so many great saints' lives. Everything seems to be flowing. You've got the monasteries are full and productive. You've got the universities that are powerful influences and engines for synthesizing, bringing together all knowledge. You've got St. Thomas Aquinas bringing together faith and reason. And, you know, so there is this great synthesis. There is this sense that the church and state work together in society. Mm-hmm. You know, all this is, you know, very wonderful. And then everything changes in about 25 years. And if you want to go back and try to find a source for that, I thought, as I was doing reading about this period, I came across an old theory that I had come across as an undergrad in history many, many years ago and had discarded it because it wasn't sophisticated enough. You know, it came back.
Uh-huh.
And the theory is called the great man theory.
Okay, what is
and
that?
The theory is that there are great individuals, men and women, who come along and change history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now it's more sophisticated nowadays to say that there are impersonal forces that do that. It might be economic forces. That's kind of a Marxist sort of an approach, or it might be geography or various kinds of determinisms and all that do that. But the great man theory has it that there are individuals who come along and who take a moment in time and then go ahead and really change the lives of people all around them. I could give you examples of that. You know?
Yeah.
So what happens in 1274 that's so important is that one of the key players, one of the great men of church history, dies that year, and that's St. Thomas Aquinas.
Oh, yes.
He was called to the Council of Lyon. It was the Second Council of Lyon, and on the way there, he died. It is, of course, an incredible loss to the church. In this age of splendor, splendiferous synthesis, you know, to lose this man. But I discovered as I was reading along also that Saint Bonaventure had died the same year. Now he's the great Franciscan, but he's also great as a Franciscan because this one man held together the Franciscans. The order was about to break asunder, which we'll talk about in a couple weeks. And he was the one who was holding it together. Once he's dead, there's nobody quite able to do that after him. So you have yet another. Then I started looking and I found that just a couple years before these two men died, St. Simon Stock, the great Carmelite, had died.
Wow.
Oh, that's interesting. And a couple years before that, St. Clare, she had died in 1252. And a couple years before that, St. Anthony of Padua.
Mm-hmm.
He died in 1231.
Those are the greats, aren't they?
Aren't they? You know, and I think, wow, this is really something. And of course, now you think if you think about that 13th century, and you've got to think also about the 12th and 13th century. You've got to think about Saint Dominic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Saint Dominic died in 1221.
Wow.
Saint Francis of Assisi died in 1226. Isn't that something?
That really is. All
yeah.
How many? I don't know if you know this. How many of them knew each other, Father? Any idea? Do we have any idea?
Yes, they did. In fact, there's a very moving relationship between St. Dominic and St. Francis of Assisi.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
At one point, I understand that the two of them were to meet in Rome. What an incredible powwow that would have been.
Yeah,
huh?
Really.
And I understand that St. Dominic had considered suggesting to St. Francis that the two orders be merged into one, like, super order.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Uh-huh.
And when Francis appeared, this little diminutive character, Dominic was so awed that he didn't even bring the topic up, and it never happened. But the two of them, you know, had this incredible respect for each other. So yeah, there was some interplay between all of these. Yeah. Interestingly enough, also shortly after the death of St. Thomas Aquinas, this is in 1274, mm-hmm. as I mentioned, a couple years later, his own teacher died. If you remember St. Albertus Magnus,
right,
Thomas started, and then shortly after that, in 1294, Roger Bacon,
mm-hmm.
the famous scientist, the Franciscan scientist, so much into philosophy and science, he himself died around that time. And then a couple years after that, in 1308, John Duns Scotus, also a Franciscan, died. And he is one more of those powerful voices arguing that faith and reason
mm-hmm.
go together, that the two support each other, paralleling everything St. Thomas Aquinas had been doing. So you can see the brain drain that takes place.
No kidding.
And that's why, you know, as I started looking at all of this happening, I started looking around and going, oh, well, okay, we lost a bunch of saints. Now, who are the saints that were taking their place? I didn't see any.
Oh.
You know, go through your hagiography,
uh-huh,
and you won't find hardly any saints over the next 50-100 years.
Wow.
Now, remember that, you know, that canonization is the church's recognition of the holiness of that life. So there might have been saints, but we just don't know about them. But the fact that we don't know about them tells us something about society at the time. So that got me interested in that. And then I thought, well, okay, fine. Maybe the church doesn't need saints, but it needs leaders. And I thought, well, no, I think the church does need saints. But, you know, can we get by without saints for a while? And then I started looking at leaders,
mm-hmm,
at popes,
mm-hmm,
and I came across another tremendous change that takes place at this very same time. The year is 1276.
Okay,
so Aquinas dies in 1274.
Uh-huh.
2 years later, the Pope dies, Gregory the
Tenth. Okay.
Well, that's not tremendous because, you know, popes die all the time, mm-hmm, you know. Well, interestingly enough, he dies in 1276. He is succeeded to the throne of Peter by Innocent the
Fifth,
who dies in 1276, the same year.
Okay.
Yeah. So the cardinals get together and they elect a new pope, Hadrian the Fifth, dies that year.
I was going to say, okay, I don't remember that name, okay.
He is succeeded to the throne by John the 21st, who dies in 1276. Could you imagine four popes in 1 year?
Oh my gosh. No,
yeah.
We remember how we all felt when we went through John Paul I to
I know.
John Paul II
yeah.
so quickly. Wow, four in 1 year.
Yeah, absolutely. It had to be shocking. Just absolutely shocking. So then a new pope is elected in 1377. Okay, this is Nicholas the Third.
1277.
I'm sorry, 1277. Thank you. Nicholas the Third. He is on the throne of Peter for 3 years.
Okay.
And then he dies.
Okay. To us now, that sounds short.
Yes, yeah, and I'm sure they were kind of hoping that he would last longer than that, too. Martin the Fourth succeeded him. He reigned for 5 years and then died. Honorius the Fourth succeeded him. He reigned for 2 years and died. I mean, you can't get any strategic planning going.
No, exactly.
Like that, you know?
How do you get the... Yeah.
Right, I mean, you barely learn the mission statement.
Let him learn who's who.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. that's exactly it. And then he succeeded by Nicholas the Fourth, who lives for 4 years.
Okay.
And then he dies. Now, I'll talk a little bit about some of this a little bit later on, but what happens is that they go then for 2 years without a pope.
Oh,
the cardinals are in gridlock and deadlock over the election of a new pope. And they just they can't come to any decision. And ultimately what they do is they decide that they need to have a holy man as the pope. They need someone who is obviously holy. And they found this poor little monk. And they said, here, you're pope. And he goes, no, I don't want to be pope. He goes, you're pope. So anyway, he's coerced back to Rome. He is then made the pope. He takes the title Celestine the Fifth. He is pope for less than 1 year. Eventually, he'll be canonized, you know, probably because of the martyrdom of the papacy. It was so terrible on this man. He couldn't make a decision. He was just a holy monk that just wanted to live in a cave and pray, you know. And all the cardinals were pulling it one way and then the other, and you know, they went back and forth. And finally, poor Celestine just said, I can't take it anymore. I'm going on retreat. So he went on retreat and never came back. Finally, a delegation of cardinals went down to his cave and said, look, you're pope. You have to come back. And he goes, no, I'm not going to. I said, you got to. And he goes, I resign. And they go, you can't resign. You're pope. He goes, I'm pope. I can do what I want. I'll resign. And so there they were with an ex-pope.
Mm-hmm.
There are only three or four examples of this in all of history.
Okay.
And so certainly
he wasn't the first to resign then?
I believe he was.
Okay.
I could name another two examples that I could think of offhand later on. That's a different
mm-hmm.
story.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a shocking event.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly when you consider the number
the
of...
The turmoil
of the constant turnover of popes. And now this guy turns around and decides he's going to retire. Well, they all get back together again. And they finally, the cardinals decided, well, okay, it didn't, holy man didn't work, so let's get an organizer. And so they elected one of their own cardinals. He chose the title Boniface VIII. And he reigned for 7 years. And we'll see him a little bit later on. He was a powerful personality. You'd have to go back to Innocent III to find a pope as powerful in personality as him. Unfortunately, he didn't carry the clout that he did before, as we'll see in his conflict with the King of France. But nonetheless, ultimately, he dies at the hands of the French. It's a very ugly situation. I'll say some things about this later. And then he is succeeded by Benedict the XI, who is beatified.
Okay.
And he is beatified mainly because of the way he died. It's pretty sure that he died for the faith, that he was martyred.
Mm.
We believe that he was poisoned.
And that was Benedict the Eighth?
Benedict the XI.
Benedict the XI.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, then what happens is, and we'll look at these guys. By the way, if you've been counting, that's 11 popes in 25 years.
Wow.
You know, not good. The next man to be elected pope is a Frenchman. He's elected in France and just never gets around to leaving. And instead, he establishes the papacy outside of Rome in Avignon.
Okay.
And this is Clement V. He reigns for 9 years. So there's a relatively
from Avignon instead of
yeah from Avignon.
Okay.
After that, you have John the 22nd for 18 years. Now you're finally getting some longevity. Benedict the 12th for 8 years. So there's some longevity here. This moves us into the Avignon papacy, which I don't want to move to yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to give you some idea of, you know, this is sort of like the great man theory in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happens when you have so many great people die off and nobody replaces them, and mm-hmm. then at the same time the official leadership of the church rotates so quickly that there's no continuity. You know, and that is just terrible. The consequences are terrible.
So prior to all of this change, they were living in just a kind of state of a utopia almost, in that, not a utopia,
well,
but I mean, it was an enlightened time.
Yeah, many European medieval historians would definitely join in and say, yes, that it was utopia.
So how long do we have to wait for that roll around again?
That's part of the problem. You know, modern historians have to concede
75.
That we haven't had it since.
No.
You know, we can throw brickbats at the Middle Ages, but the fact of the matter is that a lot of the things that the Middle Ages had, we'd love to have today and
mm-hmm.
don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's really true. Well, I don't know. You know, it might be another 100, 200 years before we get our act together. Or we might never. I don't know.
Yeah.
But at least it's something to look back at and say, wow, there was a time.
They had it once.
They did, yeah. But the incredible thing is that within 25 years, I mean, a mini generation, the whole world had changed.
Yeah.
You know, in such a short period of time, the whole climate of opinion changed. You have a young man who is sitting at the feet of St. Thomas Aquinas and seeing this great, you know, Summa Theologica,
mm-hmm.
the coming together of all theology, of philosophy, of science, and the world around us, and understanding and faith and reason, and all of those things. And at the same time, as an old man, he would be reading the writings of somebody like John Wycliffe, some others, William of Ockham, Marcellus of Padua, we'll say some things about him later on too, who are just tearing the whole synthesis apart, you know, denying the whole synthesis itself and setting up a whole different approach. The same another young man who would have been at the side of St. Louis the Ninth of France, you know, which a saint, you know, so loyal to the church, would see that, as an old man, would see that saint's grandson, Philip the Fourth, attack the church and send henchmen down to actually attack the Pope and lead to his death.
Why did he do that? What motivated him to do that?
There's great animosity between Philip and Boniface VIII. I'll read you a little bit later on. I'll read you a letter that Boniface, an encyclical, had sent out that just made the king bristle. It was a turf move. The king was trying to get money and land, and he saw that the church was an easy target for that. Mm-hmm. This is the guy who was going to lead to the suppression of the Knights Templar.
Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so he is not a nice guy, you know? and so he finds himself running afoul of the Pope. One of the things that it is part and parcel of all of this, too, is that in other previous ages, there was some mechanism of reform. There was some antidote to the stuff that was going on. It is not true this time around. You know, in the past, there had been, well, you know, the Franciscans came into existence. The Dominicans came into existence. Even before that, the Cluniac reforms in the Middle Ages. You might have a great pope that rallies and reforms the church. It's simply not going to happen this time around. In the last part of the 1200s and into the 1300s, you have a constant turnover of popes. You have the gathering of the curia. Not in Rome, but in Avignon, a very comfortable spot, but a spot that required a lot of money. And the church was poor. Believe it or not, the church, and the central authority of the church was in the Middle Ages was poor. The papacy was not wealthy by any means. And now it's out of Rome itself, and so it is beholding to other princes and lords to take care of its functions. So, and at the same time that's happening, you also have a big staff. You know, you're having the higher canon lawyers and liturgists and all of these other functionaries and scribes and all of this, and so they had to find ways to make money, and unfortunately they did, and they were rather they weren't shady, but there was kind of embarrassing fees, you know, and tithes and all kinds of things. And as a result of that, there was more and more of an emphasis on that. Interestingly enough, that if you wanted to get ahead in the curia in Avignon, your best bet would be to have a background in accounting or canon law. Mm-hmm. That's how you rose up in the ranks. Neither of those professions are particularly known for their sainthood.
Right.
You know, I mean, I can name lawyers who are saints, and I can name canon lawyers
certainly.
Who are saints, and I guess there are accountants who are saints, too. But what they do as a profession and what they were doing for the Pope was not particularly edifying in that sense. In the spiritual sense, yeah. So what happens is that the church finds itself really... having been a symbol of unity and order and cooperation, now by 1300, shortly after 1300, is spinning out of control. The medieval synthesis is disappearing, and Europe itself is falling into a confusion and a disorder, which in many ways it has not come out of yet. Mm-hmm. The answer that we came up with in Europe for order was the nation state. And you can see all the wars and difficulties that have come about with giving so much power over to a nation state, mm-hmm. and so there you just had it was pretty bad.
Father, we got a moment here. Why don't we take a quick break And we'll be back in just a few moments.
Catholic Radio on WRYT is listener-supported.
Prayer to St. Teresa of Jesus, to the Holy Faith. O Jesus, who in thy bitter passion didst become the most abject of men, a man of sorrows, I venerate thy sacred face, whereon there once did shine the beauty and sweetness of the Godhead. But now it has become for me as if it were the face of a leper. Nevertheless, under those disfigured features, I recognize thy infinite love, and I am consumed with the desire to love thee and make thee loved by all men. The tears which well up abundantly in thy sacred eyes appear to me as so many precious pearls that I love to gather up in order to purchase the souls of poor sinners by means of their infinite value. O Jesus, whose adorable face ravishes my heart, I implore thee to fix deep within me thy divine image and to set me on fire with thy love, that I may be found worthy to come to the contemplation of thy glorious face in heaven. Amen.
Okay.
All right.
let's go ahead and get into some particulars. A question that you had asked earlier on in the first segment was about the relationship between Philip IV of France, yeah, and Boniface VIII, the Pope,
mm-hmm,
and why was this animosity? So this might be a good chance to start looking at that, say some things about how Boniface got elected, the very fact that he got elected put him into a camp in which there were enemies in Italy already running around.
Okay.
And so it was an opportunity for Philip to take advantage of this. Okay. You remember that Celestine V was had been the Pope, basically Pope for about 6 months. And then he was just overwhelmed with the responsibilities, resigned. And it's Boniface VIII who actually had gone down to Celestine's cave and convinced him to come back, but instead he resigned instead. He then is elected Pope, and there are those who begin wondering whether or not he hadn't orchestrated the whole thing.
Oh.
You know, Boniface VIII, in order,
yeah,
to be elected himself. But we have no evidence of that,
okay,
but you know, it was something for rumor mills to get going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were those people who were saying, well, can a pope actually resign? Okay. Well, we know that he can, but it hadn't happened before.
And at that time, was it a position that was so desired?
Yes, it was.
It was.
Unfortunately, it was desired, and we find this often in history. It's desired by certain families.
Oh.
You know that.
Okay.
So there's that family control thing,
mm-hmm,
that goes on, and you have to understand that, you know, that Rome and Italy that we know today is not the same Rome in 1200,
right,
in 1300.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's a rough and tumble place.
Mm-hmm.
The best example I came across it recently was I saw this movie called The Gangs of New York. You know, that was Rome in 1300. I mean, they had gangs,
okay,
and there were assassinations and all kinds of ugly things went back and forth, and the popes were not immune to this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when Boniface was elected, he had people, especially one family in particular, that were very much against him. The Colonna family,
okay,
was a very powerful Italian family that resented the fact that he had become the Pope. And then worse than that, he convinced Celestine to move back to Rome and to take up residence in a papal palace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not right for a former pope to live in a cave. You know? Well, Celestine finally agreed to do that, moved back to Rome, and died shortly after.
Okay.
So, of course, all the rumors went around again. You know, was Boniface trying to get rid of this guy because of the embarrassment of having, you know, an ex-pope and all that? Well, anyway, this is the opportunity that the King of France, Philip IV, has. He makes an alliance with the Colonna family.
Oh, okay.
Okay. His nickname is Philip the Fair, And that's not because he fights fair. It's because of his fair complexion.
Yeah, okay.
There was nothing else fair about him besides that. But he pressed his position in order to become as absolute a monarch in France as possible. And to do that, he has to control the nobles, which he was doing a pretty good job of, and he had to control the church mm-hmm. in France also. And as a result of that, there is this conflict. Now, the popes had just fought, in the last part of the Middle Ages, had just fought this terrible fight with the German emperor about lay investiture.
Oh,
it was the
yeah.
question of who decides who a bishop mm-hmm. will be. Will it be the emperor? Will it be the pope? And now all of a sudden, and the popes won that,
mm-hmm.
now all of a sudden the king of France wants to have the same argument over again, you know, about lay investiture. So Boniface has to stand up to Philip on that question. Then the next question comes along, okay, fine, I'm going to tax everybody in my country, including the clergy. Well, this has been a traditional privilege that the church has had, not to be taxed. I mean, after all the work that the church does with that money, it was incredible. There was no education except for Catholic education in France.
Mm-hmm.
There was no social welfare except for Catholic social welfare in France. All of the social services that we consider today to be part and parcel of our government, those social services were conducted by the church. It was considered to be the purview of the church, but the church needed money in order to do those sorts of things. Well, here he is coming in now and exerting his right to tax the first estate, the church. Boniface reacts by sending a nasty letter to him in 1296, saying that there is no such thing as clerical tax, that you cannot tax the church, you cannot tax churchmen. In 1301, Philip steps a little bit further, and he arrests a French bishop for taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's going a little bit far. And he's charged with treason, and it's all trumped up. And in response to this arrest, then, Boniface reacts again, and this time issues his great letter called Unum Sanctum. This is what really sets off Philip. But I'd like to read you a couple passages from Unum Sanctum to have some sort of a sense of what an attack it is on Philip IV and telling him to get back in line with everybody else. The letter starts out by saying this: "The true faith compels us to believe that there is one holy Catholic apostolic church, and this we firmly believe and plainly confess." Then the Pope takes several scriptural passages in order to show the singularity of the church, that it's one holy Catholic and apostolic, and he's going to lead on that there's only one leader of that church, and it ain't you, Phil, you know. Later on, he writes this. He says this in that same letter. He says, "For the truth itself declares that the spiritual power must establish the temporal power and pass judgment on it." See, you know,
mm-hmm.
the Pope on the king, or the other way around. "If it is not good, thus the prophecy of Jeremiah concerning the church and the ecclesiastical power is fulfilled. See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out and to pull down and to destroy and to throw down, to build and to plant." Jeremiah 1:10. Therefore, if the temporal power errs, it will be judged by the spiritual power. And if the lower spiritual power errs, it will be judged by its superior. Then he goes on to say that if the superior spiritual power, in other words, me, errs, God will take care of me. Yeah. It's not your problem. God will take care of it. He goes on and then emphasizes, he quotes from Matthew 16:19. He's talking about the Lord to Peter, making Peter the rock. And he says this, he says, "And the rock was made firm to him and to his successors in Christ himself, whom he had confessed. For the Lord said to Peter, whatsoever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Matthew 16:19. Therefore, whoever resisteth this power thus ordained of God resisteth the ordinance of God. Romans 13:2. He's really throwing some stuff at him. And then finally, he ends with this. We therefore declare, say, and affirm that submission on the part of every man to the Bishop of Rome is altogether necessary for his salvation. Wow. Tough stuff. You know,
Philip. You laid it out there for
us. it's unambiguous. Definitely unambiguous. And Philip just it was enraged over this. Mm-hmm. He called together the three estates of France, the first estate, clergy, the second estate, nobles, third estate, everybody else, and formed then together what's called the Estates General. Only rarely in French history are these things called. They're like constitutional conventions. They're very, and what he was doing was he was trying to rally all of the people of France to his side in this tremendous struggle that's going to take place between the Pope and the King.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly read his recent history and knew what happened when he had the struggle between the Pope and the German Emperor.
Right.
You know, and so, but he has a secret weapon.
Wow.
And his secret weapon is the Italian family. And the head of that family, Sciarra Colonna, who is as evil as can be, and he meets with the Chancellor of France.
Mm-hmm.
This is also a really shady character, Guillaume de Nogaret. And they made a pact together in Italy. With French support, the Colonna family would attack the Pope himself and kill him.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's what they decided to do. Here's Boniface VIII, 75 years old. He's staying outside of Rome at the palace at Anagni. And they broke into the palace. And they surrounded the room where Boniface was. And all of the papal, he didn't, I think all of the servants mm-hmm. and ministers, they all fled. And so here's Boniface by himself. And finally they broke into his room also. And when they did, he was standing there in full papal regalia. And here are these assassins, you know, a dozen assassins, their knives and everything. And he says to them, here is my head. Here's my throat. And they just walked away. They couldn't do it. Until they got outside and came across the Colonnas. Mm-hmm. You get back in there and get it. Well, they didn't. What they did was they arrested him. And they put him under house arrest. But they beat him up so badly that he died shortly after.
Hmm.
Well, what happens then is when the cardinals gather back together again.
Now who wants the job?
Yeah, who wants the job? Isn't that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why really when you look at the life, the very short papal life mm-hmm. of Benedict XI, this man is probably a saint.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the church, as I said, is beatified him. But when he allowed himself to be elected Pope in with the title Benedict XI, and when he allowed himself to be elected and then turned around and excommunicated the Colonna family and Guillaume de Nogaret, the French minister, that was gutsy.
Yes, it was.
And he didn't live long mm-hmm. afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
He was poisoned, we're very sure of that. And while we don't have a smoking vial, we're pretty sure that it was done by the Colonnas and by the French, mm-hmm. by Guillaume de Nogaret. What happens then is that the cardinals themselves, it is so dangerous to stay in France that they all packed up and they moved. I'm sorry, it's so dangerous to stay in
wow.
Rome.
Mm-hmm.
They all packed up and they moved to southern France.
Okay.
But you have to remember that France at this time is not the France that we have today. There are other countries within France. So that, for instance, in the southern part of France, there's an area called the Provence. Okay, it's along the coastline, and with the Mediterranean. It was its own country for a short period of time. Burgundy was its own country. It's a pretty powerful country within France for centuries. Further to the west, much of that area is actually owned and dominated by the English. So there are a significant number of Frenchmen who are actually in league with the English. And so when we talk about the French, we have to be careful that that there are actually several different factions of French. That understood, as the conclave gathered together to elect a new pope, you had factions, and you had the basic faction were Italians on the one side saying they wanted another Italian pope, but then you know the question is who's it going to be, and on the other side you had French cardinals saying no, we need to deal with this King of France, our king, or you know those who are following the King of England, our enemy, you know, but we need to be able to deal with him. Someone from France needs to be the next pope. And so they finally decided in 1305, at the conclave, they elected the cardinal, the archbishop. He was not a cardinal. They elected the Archbishop of Bordeaux in southern France. Okay. They had enough votes, both from the French and from the French who were English, you know, the English-French, to win that election for the Archbishop of Bordeaux. They had great hope for this man because he was a personal friend of Philip IV.
Okay.
And they thought through personal diplomacy that they could win the king over and he would moderate his attack. Because even after Boniface was dead, he was still using propaganda, just besmirching this man's name. You know, saying that he was involved with black magic and there were, you know, all kinds of witchcraft stuff going on, that he was a homosexual and, you know, all kinds of things like this. And so they were really trying to find some way to moderate that. And they thought that by electing the Archbishop of Bordeaux that would make a difference. He chose the title Clement V.
Okay.
And he decided to be installed as Pope, coronated. In France, he chose the ancient Christian city of Lyon.
Okay.
And you know you can't fault him for that. It was close by. It had all the stuff necessary, the whole works, but it was an absolute disaster. The coronation was a disaster. During the parade, the procession going down one of the streets, people had hovered. I mean, they were all over the place, hanging off of everything to watch this. And there was a bleachers set up, but not very well. And it was overcrowded, and it collapsed just as the Pope was passing by.
Oh my gosh.
And there were scores of people who were killed. They were crushed to death. There was a nobleman who was knocked off his horse and crushed to death. The Pope himself was jostled, and the tiara fell from his head and smashed on the ground, and they were able to recover the tiara, but one of the, like a ruby or something, was missing. It's never been found since.
Hmm.
You know, it's just kind of a lousy way to get started.
Yes.
And so what he does then is that after the coronation takes place, of course, the question came up, when are we going to Rome?
All right.
Mm-hmm. And he says, well, you know, soon, but I got some work to do first here, you know. The other thing, too, about Clement is because he becomes very concerned about his health.
Okay.
No sooner was he coronated, and he went into this long period of time in which nobody except his nephews could see him. And this went on for months. And he was very, very careful about what he ate. Well, when you consider what happened,
well, what's happened to his predecessor,
mm-hmm. you kind of sort of understand that.
Uh-huh.
But the long and short of it was that no decisions were made.
Right,
everything was put off.
How does anything get finished,
yeah.
right?
And so, sort of by default, he decided not to go to Rome, but rather to wait until it was right, until the time was right. And he looked around, and the Vatican had bought a piece of property in southern France a number of years back, a little tiny country called Avignon.
Oh, yes.
Lovely little place. Mm-hmm. And so he decided just to hang out in Avignon. And the long and short of it was that he never left.
Well.
You know.
Okay. Why? Why did that continue on that way?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the answer is carrot and stick. On the one hand, you know, if they went back to Rome, mm-hmm. you've got those factions to deal with. His own personal safety couldn't be assured. Not only that, I mean, you know, these guys don't necessarily want to be martyrs. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't mind being martyrs for the faith, but not for, you know, these petty political things. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be killed. Mm-hmm. They don't want their families to be killed. They, you know, a lot of them had nephews and uncles and all who were also priests and there at the court. They didn't want other members of the curia to be put into harm's way. Mm-hmm. So it was a dangerous thing to mm-hmm. go to Rome. Now, that's the stick. The carrot is that Avignon is very, very nice. Mm-hmm. It's got a very pleasant climate. Rome in the summer can be blistering. You know, there's this terrible wind that comes out of North Africa, goes right across Malta and right up into Italy called the Sirocco. And it can be sweltering. So, you know, you're looking at that. Besides that, it's a region that's famous for its foods. It's not too far from the sea, so you get good seafood. It's not too far from the valleys and plains, so you get, you know, good beef and you know, all that kind of stuff. And not to forget, the wine.
I was going to say, the wine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking, you know, Bordeaux and Chateau Neuf de Pape and Burgundy. You know, those are a lot of names, mm-hmm. Wine names. And so there was a lot of reason to kind of dawdle.
Mm-hmm.
And he dawdled his entire life. Mm-hmm. His successor is John the 22nd, and we'll be talking about him later on. Very important pope at a very critical time in church history. And once again, not real interested in leaving. Ultimately, as these Avignon popes, as they come to be known, and they're there for 70 years.
Is that how long I can remember?
Yeah, it was about 70 years. Over that period of time, they build this incredible fortress palace. It is just massive. It's still there today.
I was just going to say.
Oh, yeah, that. Yeah. And you can visit this thing. It is just as impressive as can be. And it is upheld or held out siege equipment for in many, many sieges. It is just tremendous. But the other side of it is then it's very hard to leave.
Yeah.
And it'll take 70 years before a pope finally does. It'll be Gregory the 11th. And that only at the insistence of that great spiritual master, Catherine of Siena.
Oh, yes.
Siena.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And the persuasion that she'll do in order to pull that off. But there we have it. This period of time, yeah, it's 1305 to 1376. The Pope doesn't get back to Rome until 1378.
Wow.
So 75 years of absence. It's been called the Babylonian captivity and other things of that nature. If it is, the fact of the matter is that these guys weren't trying to get away real bad.
They were.
Yeah.
Well, the Avignon papacies have always interested me.
I had always had a pretty low opinion of those guys until I really read their lives more carefully.
Uh-huh.
And I have a newfound respect for the popes in Avignon. They were really trying to do their best,
mm-hmm.
you know, working with the limitations of their age. But they were really trying to do their best. And I think as we look at them more carefully, we can see them as men of their age,
mm-hmm.
foibled and faulty and all. But trying to rule the church as best they can under really rough circumstances.
Well, that's what I hope to hear, Father.
Okay. Well, yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've come to the end of show number one as far as our timing. And so can you give us a little brief look at next week's show?
Next week we are going to be looking at this whole thing of the the captives in Babylon, whether or not they were really captives or not. We'll look at the life at the papal court in Avignon, what that was like. Some of the popes, I mentioned John the 22nd, very important individual. We'll take a look at Benedict the 12th, also very powerful individual. And then I'm going to introduce a theory to you. I introduced it to the seminarians this past semester, and they all kind of looked at me like I had two heads. because I was throwing Hegelian dialectics at them. but I think it might make some sense in trying to understand this age and then for the next several hundred years in church history, what happens. So,
sounds good.
There you go.
Would you close with a prayer and a blessing for us?
Sure. Glory to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. In the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.
Thank you, Father.
Okay.